Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Council Chairman Doug Clyde. Later on, the co-chair of the Wasatchback chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby, Lauren Barrows, with details on what the chapter is up to, their monthly virtual meetings and hikes. Finally, Executive Director of Park City Film, Katie Wang, has her monthly update and a look ahead at the winter season. And a heads up for those of you who travel along Kearns Boulevard, there will be a repaving project tonight. The intersection of Kearns and Bonanza Drive will close between 8 and 10 p.m. tonight for repaving. Detour routes will be posted to assist vehicle traffic during the closure. You'll need to use Sidewinder and Prospector Avenues to bypass the Bonanza intersection as well as to access Monitor Drive. Well, the defendants in Summit County's lawsuit against the developers hoping to build in Richardson Flat accepted the term of Summit County's preliminary injunction on Tuesday. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more on that.
Developers Nick Brockbank and Josh Romney agreed to a preliminary injunction along the same terms as a temporary restraining order put in place on September 9th by Utah's 3rd District Court. The decision means Brockbank, Romney, and their associates are unable to move forward with any development plans regarding disputed parcels of land in the Richardson Flat area of Summit County. A court hearing to decide whether the restraining order would become a preliminary injunction scheduled for September 22nd is now canceled. The two parcels disputed in the lawsuit are known as SS87 and SS88 and lie just east of Park City along State Route 248. Summit County alleges the developers obtained the parcels in an improper foreclosure sale with Wells Fargo Bank in February of this year and then illegally subdivided the parcels to exclude land designated as an EPA hazardous waste zone. Brockbank and Romney had approached the town of Hideout along the Jordanelle Reservoir earlier this year about annexing about 650 acres of land into the town in order to build commercial services, office space, and additional residential units. The Hideout Town Council voted to try again to annex into Summit County last week, this time entering into a pre-annexation agreement with Brockbank for about 380 acres that excludes the parcels Summit County disputes. The council also voted for a new resolution of intent to annex the land in Summit County. Hideout has 30 days from the passage of their resolution of intent to hold public hearings and vote on whether or not to officially continue the annexation process. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
News time 8:12.
Hi, I'm Julie Hopkins with Keller Williams Real Estate. I love our great community and all the amazing nonprofits that make it the fantastic place it is. And it's a pleasure to support the KPCW Local News Hour with Leslie Thatcher to stay up to date on the critical issues facing our community, as well as the human interest stories that are the heartbeat of our town. Real estate information, jhparkcity.com.
The Summit County Council yesterday overruled the upheld the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission to issue a conditional use permit for the Summit County Clubhouse. This is a gathering place for those working on their mental wellness. On the phone with a recap of that, as well as the rest of the meeting, I have Summit County Council Member and Chair Doug Clyde. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Leslie.
So you did cast your vote to deny the appeal. How come?
This one is really pretty simple. Within our residential zones, which is what we're talking about mostly out in the county, within our residential zones, we have a fair number of other uses that include things like group homes, that include things like, somebody's just telling me you can't hear me very well. Can you hear me?
Well, it sounds different. Yeah.
Okay, hang on.
How's that? Any better?
A lot better. Thank you.
Okay. In any event, there are a variety of uses within our residential zones that are not purely residential, and they include things, for example, like bed and breakfasts and group homes of various types and personal improvement centers, which is, I believe, how we classify this one. And they are ways for people to use facilities that are fairly low intensity in their use, but can locate them within residential properties. And this was just simply a matter of there was a fair amount of opposition to it by some neighbors, of course, who just didn't want to see that use in their neighborhood. And so they proceeded to file an appeal. But when it came down to the facts, there was virtually no way that, A, the permit could be denied, and they had really had presented no evidence that would support a denial of the application.
Yeah. You apparently had a few people on the Zoom traffic wanting to comment. You had to explain that it was not a public hearing. It was too late for that?
Right. There are many things that we do that we being the county that are decided at the planning commission level. In other words, the county council does not have to approve every coffee shop or other minor use. And this is one of those things. These are what we would consider to be relatively easy, simple conditional uses. And a conditional use is simply a use that is otherwise allowed in the zone, but because of its activities, it may be necessary to look at it and put conditions on it that make it compatible, that minimize its impacts. And so this is one of those types of permits. When that permit gets approved, everybody has the right to appeal, just as if it was a court action, essentially. And we become the quasi-judicial body that hears the appeal.
I recall, of course, the senior facility that was proposed and then built there in the Highland Estate areas that neighbors
right.
were up in arms against. And then, again, those of Trailside, when the LDS Church wanted to build, and I think they've both found that both of those make really good neighbors.
Well, I don't think that that any of the fears, especially the dark fears that were brought up about the senior center, albeit I can't remember what dark fears about that they were thinking, but have come true. You're right. They're good neighbors. You know, yes. There may be a half a dozen residents in one of those properties, but that if they're properly designed and operated, that does not mean that they're incompatible.
Yeah, and I guess the homeowners association, their next step would be just to take it to court.
That's their only option at this point. Yes.
All right. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about a topic discussed at the Council of Governments meeting, the COG meeting on Monday. For about 10 years, the emergency medical services on the east side has been run by the Park City Fire District. Now some volunteers, mayors, and others on the eastern side of the county, especially in South Summit, say they would like to run the EMS themselves. You said you've talked to these folks about this for the last 3 years. What have you heard?
Well, first of all, even though the ambulance service has been run by Park City Fire, it has involved and still has involved volunteers from the east side of the county throughout the years. Ever since ambulance service was first offered over here, part of the staffing, if not all of the staffing, depending on the time, has been volunteer-based. And we of course have some very committed and very competent people who do that work over here on a volunteer basis, and they have I've been approached by an individual who does that work who was very unhappy with the way things were run. Now that's so we've been pursuing those comments now for some time as we've been looking at the overall organization, and then in the meantime, North Summit Fire had to hire a new chief, and so we've been before we continue the conversation, we've been waiting for the new chief to get on board, and now we'll begin to go back and look at the situation and try and determine whether the interests of the residents on the east side of the county are better served by a separate facility from one that is operated by Park City Fire.
You say the issue is impacted by what you called community differences between the east and west side. So what do you mean by that?
I'm not sure the context of that, but One of the nature of the East versus West relative to something like EMS is that, of course, the East is far more scattered. Our population is geographically far more diversely located. And as a result of that, there are differences in the way service can be provided and the question of what is most effective. And often, maybe often is not the right word, occasionally I've heard that one of the things that we get out of our volunteer force is sometimes they're right there. Sometimes they're there faster than the ambulance is. So that's perhaps what I was alluding to.
Another issue apparently is that it's getting harder to get EMS volunteers who are based in the community. Why is that happening here?
Right. First of all, just in general, that's a trend. As every community grows and matures, the interest of the general population in volunteering for those sorts of activities tend to decline. That's logical and rational, because if you think about it, as your community gets bigger, you have less and less contact with you as an individual who lives there, has less and less contact with all of your neighbors. You're not as close to them. However, the existing volunteer community here feels quite strongly that they can muster sizable forces, if you will.
So they believe the problem would be resolved if it were run locally.
That's right. They believe that their concerns would be better addressed, and that they would be able to supply perhaps better personnel as well.
The county has an EMS board, so what's the county council's role in addressing the problem?
Well, it is that it's to accept the essentially to look at the recommendations of the EMS board and act on that, and that's where this will go. That's where this discussion will go, is to the EMS board.
All right. As we just reported, the defendants in Summit County's lawsuits against developers Nate Brockbank and Josh Romney agreed to a preliminary injunction along the same terms there as the temporary restraining order. Any other updates there on Hideout?
Not really. Things are moving and shifting underfoot at all times, but no actions to report or additional legal actions on our part.
All right. And then regarding COVID, the county handling it fairly well. There are, of course, the headlines about a spike overall in the state of Utah. In fact, one of the highest numbers of cases reported in the state yesterday. Any comment on that?
No, simply, a couple of things. One, yes, you're right there. First of all, Summit County is doing a very good job, is what the numbers essentially say. Things are generally going well. The rate of new infections is relatively low. We're not precisely where we want to be, but we're darn close. And so that aspect of it is great. What we know so far about school and the disease within the schools currently is that it is the incidents have been very minor, that things seem to be going as planned in terms of being able to control the virus within the schools. The problem that we're seeing in the state has primarily been Utah County has been fingered prominently in that. Precisely why they have such a high rate is not known, but we've known that that they were, as a population, perhaps resistant to wearing masks, and as we found out in Summit County, that's the key. This is really pretty simple. Social distance, wear masks, and just do your best to not expose yourself. But if you don't do that, you're going to get the virus likely. So that's where we're at. We're doing a good job. The state overall is doing okay, but they need to improve.
All right. Anything else you wanted to mention?
I think that's it, Leslie.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time. That's the chair of the Summit County Council, Doug Clyde. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Still to come, we'll be talking with the co-chair of the Wasatch Back Chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby, Lauren Barros. Later on in the hour, the director of Park City Film, Katie Wang, with an update. First, Summit County Health Director Rich Bulla gave a brief COVID update to the Summit County Council of Governments on Tuesday night. He raised the question, just how long will the county's mandatory mask order be in place? The short answer is, don't throw away your face mask anytime soon. During that electronic meeting, Bulla noted that the mask order was recently extended. He said he does not anticipate the order will be lifted until a significant proportion of the population has been vaccinated. And he added he doesn't have any special knowledge about when a vaccination might appear.
You've all been reading the press just like I have. I don't have any inside information. I'm on a weekly call with the state. That's pretty much the only inside information I have. And what they've told us is consistent with generally what you're hearing in the press, and that is that we may have approved vaccines by the end of the year, perhaps shortly after, so the first part of 2021. There have been some complications in some of the trials that you've probably heard about.
And he also talked about how a vaccine may roll out here in Summit County.
In Summit County, we are literally only expecting about 300 vaccines. And those vaccines will go to first responders and medical providers. So we're going to triage the way that we approach this. I don't anticipate that we'll be in the full throes of mass vaccinations until mid to late winter. And I honestly believe it's going to be spring to midsummer before we're really to a place where we have a significant proportion vaccinated. So that's probably not the news you want to hear, but I think that's the most accurate information I have.
Summit County Health Director Rich Bulla. The Park City Education Foundation started its Beat the Call campaign on Monday. It's a unique opportunity to leverage fundraising efforts this year. Carolyn Murray has more on that.
The Park City Education Foundation, like most nonprofits, has had to pivot their fundraising efforts this year due to COVID-19 distancing precautions. Executive Director Abby McNulty told KPCW, for the first time in a couple of decades of fall fundraising, they have a matching challenge grant of $50,000. Their goal is to get 100% participation from everyone who has a child in the district.
Yeah, well, we're so grateful. Three families came together to provide us with a matching grant of $50,000 to support our efforts in our back-to-school Beat the Call fundraising campaign. So every donation that's given between the start of school and September 25th will be matched dollar for dollar up to $50,000.
McNulty says there is a significant need to have philanthropic investments made in the classroom because 96% of the school tax dollars are redistributed to other districts around the state.
All of our programs that we fund are on our website, pcef4kids.org, and they're listed by school as well if you're interested in seeing how PCEF supports your kid at Treasure Mountain or Ecker Hill or Jeremy Ranch, for example. And we also have key initiatives that we support, so preschool and after school and elementary art and the Park City CAPS program and Bright Futures. We have large initiatives that we invest in each year.
They fund about 100 programs, which are found throughout the entire school district. They're emphasizing new initiatives this year to help teachers conduct classes virtually and to help underserved families with school supplies.
And then new for us this year is a really robust emergency grant program for teachers that we started when our schools closed in March, and our teachers had to transition to remote learning. There was a need for last-minute funds to support, you know, new needs that were cropping up because of the new learning environment. Those funds supported everything from technology tools for teachers to at-home learning supplies for families, and we're continuing that program this year at a much more robust level, and we've already distributed resources through that emergency teacher grant fund to support things like outdoor classrooms.
The UPS store sponsors the Beat the Call campaign and plans to grant $8,000 to the school that has the highest number of donation participants. A link to the Park City Ed Foundation can be found on kpcw.org. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
Well, the Wasatch Back of the Utah Climate Change Lobby meets tonight and meets monthly on the phone with details about the lobby as well as an upcoming hike this weekend. I have the co-chair, Lauren Barrows. Good morning to you, Lauren.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. So begin just by telling us a little bit about your organization.
Oh, thanks for giving me the opportunity. We have a local chapter here in the Wasatch Back of the Citizens Climate Lobby. It's a organization with 400 chapters across the U.S., and our focus is to gain bipartisan support for climate change legislation, climate change solutions, and to build a grassroots and grass tops community of people who want to work on climate change from small things like talking with their neighbors about it to big things like lobbying our federal representatives.
Yeah, is it a bipartisan organization?
It is. We're completely nonpartisan.
Yeah. And how many members do you have in the local chapter?
We have over 200.
Okay. And what is it that you guys are working on?
Well, right now, we do meet monthly. We're meeting tonight at 6:30 by Zoom. And if anyone's interested, they can come to our Facebook page to get the Zoom link, or they can email us at citizens, or it's wasatchback@citizensclimatelobby.org. And then each month we talk about things we're working on. And for example, this month we're doing a hike this Saturday with Mayor Andy Bierman from Park City, Mayor Celeste Johnson from Midway, and Mayor Colleen Potter from Heber. And we're doing that hike at 9 a.m. Saturday at Daly Canyon. And we're going to talk about what they're doing, how they can work together on their solutions for climate change and or what their thoughts are. We had those three mayors together in a town hall that we put on in the summer of 2019. And at that time, we started talking about climate change and possible solutions. And I think they've done a lot since then about the environment and clean air and climate change. So I'm pretty excited about that hike. Because of COVID, we're limiting it to 15 people. So we'll need RSVPs. We're close to the max, but we still have room for a handful more.
Okay, and people can RSVP then on the website? Is that how they do it?
They can email me at wasatchback@citizensclimatelobby.org, or they can contact us through the Facebook page. Either of those would be great ways to reach us. And then we have a lot of other stuff going on. We are meeting with, we're doing another hike in October with Representative Curtis. There are a couple of us who are doing that, who are continuing a talk that we had with him during our lobby day earlier this summer in June. And we've got a regional conference that we're holding by Zoom at the end of this month with a lot of great calls. I'm sorry. I got a call at the same time. With a lot of great conferences and great panels that will be going on.
Okay. Now, are those free then for people to join in on?
Everything with Citizens Climate Lobby is free. The regional conference is free. The joining the group is free. It's a nonprofit 501c4 organization, and we would love to have more community involvement.
Yeah, and back to the hike with the mayors. Again, talking about I guess what in anything in specifically.
You know, at that time that we had the town hall in the summer of 2019, someone asked Mayor Colleen Potter of Heber, how are you all working together on this, or what is it that you're doing? And she said, I think this might be a good start. And I know since that time, Mayor Potter has become co-chair of an I think it's a carbon dividend, Utahns for Carbon Dividends organization, or maybe it's just, I think that's what it is. And we haven't spoken with her since, and I thought it'd be really great to hear from her and have her talk with the other mayors about that and what she's doing and keep that conversation going. So I'm pretty excited about that. Last month we had a hike on the same location with Blake Moore, who was the Republican running for the Republican nomination for Rob Bishop's seat, and he won the Republican nomination. And so we wanted to talk with him at that time about his thoughts on climate change solutions. And really, we also just wanted to start building a relationship with him. And at the time, a lot of younger people came from Americans with Carbon Dividends and another American Carbon Conservative group. And that was really cool, too, just to start talking with them and have conversations to get to know each other, really, and also talk about our thoughts about climate change and what we can do about it.
Yeah. Heber City, of course, at one point was considering subscribing to a nuclear power plant that would be built in Idaho. Has the lobby taken a position on nuclear energy?
We don't. We really don't. We try to stay out of that. Our focus is really just on building solutions for climate change, and we can't, as an organization, take a stance on nuclear power pro or con.
Okay. In June, you wrote a letter to the editor of the Salt Lake Tribune titled, People of Color Bear the Burden of Climate Change. How is that?
People of color disproportionately bear the burden in that the worst effects of climate change hit people in communities of color harder physically, geographically. So, for example, just one concrete example would be the refineries in Salt Lake City. They're all on the west side, located where the biggest concentration of people of color reside. That's just a really tangible way to see it. But also and I think that's not unique. It's replicated throughout the United States and throughout the world. And then many countries that have populations of people who are islanders, they're being hardest hit by climate change. People, let's say you take the example of the wildfires. Many people in Oregon right now, in communities of color who are often in cities, have no place to go to get out of the bad air. You know, they can't go to their, they can't go to the suburbs as easily. And I'm not saying that people of color just live in cities, but I there's so many examples. And I think the one for me that really is most obvious for us here locally is that refinery example.
Yeah. And then this notion, this term of climate justice, I mean, what does that mean? And is that something you're
climate
trying to solve?
Yeah. For me, it is. It really is. It's, and I think that for the Citizens Climate Lobby, they are as well. We're really trying to bring about a just transition to a clean energy world. And one way would be to make it so that there's pending legislation in Congress right now called the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. And that bill was the culmination of work by the Citizens Climate Lobby. And that the idea of that is that you do put a price on carbon and tax or charge a fee for carbon at the mine or the well. But then that money goes into a pot that's administered by the Treasury that goes back to each American in equal amounts per American. And so that would help poorer people with less income, more than people with higher income. In other words, if everyone gets the same check, it's going to represent a larger person or larger percentage of each person's income who earns less I hope that made sense.
Yeah.
But another way to look at it is a just transition for community, like coal communities or communities that historically have produced fossil fuels. So, for example, Price, Utah, it's a community that centered its economy around coal. And as coal is dying, they're desperate to find other avenues for revenue. And I think it's really important to help those communities as well develop other ways to thrive so that we can have their support and so that we can help those people there as well. So that's when I talk about a just transition or environmental justice. All of those things come into play.
Yeah. So where are we then with that National Carbon Fee and Dividend Act? I mean, has it stalled in Congress? Is it moving forward?
It continues to gain co-sponsors. It has over 80 co-sponsors right now, but it really needs more Republican co-sponsors. And my understanding is that not much is happening in a bipartisan way in Congress at the moment. But I think that our federal delegation is going to be really helpful with this, I hope. I know that Representative Curtis is very supportive of doing something about climate change, many things about climate change. I don't know that he supports this act in particular. I don't think he does at the moment. But I know that Senator Romney has mentioned carbon dividends and that he's also on a bipartisan climate solutions caucus in the Senate. I know that Blake Moore, if he does become our representative, indicated that he would be very supportive of taking some concrete action towards climate solutions, which is encouraging as well. And then Representative Ben McAdams is very supportive of this bill, too.
Okay. Lauren, anything else you wanted to add?
Oh, just that I encourage anyone who has an interest to contact us and participate in our meeting. Our meetings are easy. They're short. We're on time. We end on time. And it's the third Thursday of every month at 6:30 for now by Zoom. And participate in our hikes and join us any way you can.
Okay. Lauren Barrows, again, the co-chair of the Wasatch BAC of the Utah Climate Change Lobby. Thanks for your time this morning.
You bet. Thank you, Leslie.
Well, the Park City film series Twilight Drive-Ins continue this weekend. On the phone with an update, I have the executive director of Park City Film, Katie Wang. Good morning, Katie.
Good morning, Leslie.
So what's on tap for this weekend?
Well, it's our final weekend of the Twilight Drive-In, which is a little sad, but we're ending on a high note, which is exciting always. And we're bringing in our annual slate of ski films, and we actually have three different premieres. So we're bringing in Matchstick Productions' latest film. These are the films we bring in every year into the Jim Santee Auditorium and now at the Utah Olympic Park. And it's a film called Huck Yeah. And like all great ski films, it gets us ready for winter and reminds us how important it is to spend time outdoors with your friends, having fun, and speaks to the spirit of the mountain community that we live in. This will be actually kind of exciting in that it's going to be a premiere for ski towns across the West. So we'll be part of six different ski towns, including Gunnison, Colorado, and Aspen, and Sun Valley. We'll all be showing the film at the same time on Friday night. So we'll have two shows on Friday, one at 7, which is almost sold out. I think there's 5 tickets left to that one. And then again at 9 o'clock, when we have probably 50 tickets left to that show. The first 50 ticket buyers for that second show will get an insulated Stanley mug. So that's always fun. People love their swag. And we're going to have a third show on Sunday, but we decided to pull that back so that we can focus more on the other film that we're bringing in. So if you want to come see Huck Yeah, definitely get your tickets today at parkcityfilm.org because that will sell out for those two shows, and those are the only two shows we'll have. And then on Sunday night, we're doing two more premieres. One is called American Downhiller, and this is the history of the sport of downhill racing in the U.S. and how the evolution from pioneers Buddy Warner and Billy Kidd in the 50s and 60s to Bill Johnson, to recent stars like Steve Nyman, Claire Brown, who's a Park City-based ski racer, is one of the producers on it. And so that'll be at 7 o'clock on Sunday night. And then we're also pairing that film with another film called Maiden Voyage, which is the story of two skiers. It's a short film, two skiers who revamp a vintage ski bus and take an epic ski road trip throughout Colorado and Utah and ultimately ending up in British Columbia. But American Downhillers, great local story. We'll have a bunch of our local athletes. Steve Nyman will be here, Mark O'Sullivan, Brian Friedman, Doug Lewis, and of course, Claire Brown, the producer, will be on site for a Q&A. And there'll be some great giveaways from POC and Cole Sport, who are the sponsors for that film. And then we also want to thank Julie Hopkins, Keller Williams Real Estate, for underwriting Huck Yeah. So just a great collection of films, you know, all kind of the first time anyone's putting eyes on these stories, and just a great way, we think, to end out an incredible season up at the Utah Olympic Park.
Okay. So what kind of summer has it been with both your virtual and drive-in revenues?
The drive-ins have been incredible. I mean, it's one of those reasons where it just reminds you of why you love living in Park City and in a small town. I mean, it's been an incredible partnership. We definitely could not have done this on our own. We're a small organization, but Dragonfly Media brought, you know, incredible technology, Utah Olympic Park, I mean, the most scenic, I think, drive-in in Utah, arguably, and just the response from the community. By the end, I was just running some numbers. We will have, by the end of the drive-in, we will have shown 33 film screenings. We will have hosted over 2,000 cars and about over 7,000 people. So it's been, you know, amazing to see people just coming out, coming back, and just the joy that it brings to the community to be able to come together again, to be entertained and inspired and just kind of escape. I mean, that's the beauty of cinema, and that's certainly the beauty of the arts. It's just, you know, for a moment you can live a completely different life and just be immersed and, you know, taken away from the day-to-day reality, which is a little challenging right now. So it's been, you know, unbelievable, the partnership. I can't thank them enough. And then the response from the community, you know, Switchback Sports, Buddy Drops, Made in Park City, the Bill White Restaurant Group, Julie Hopkins with Keller Williams Real Estate, and PJ Builders. I mean, again, it's just, you know, we're all in this together, and it's been incredibly just heartening and just the highlight, I think, of perhaps my time at Park City Film, but certainly this summer of, you know, being able to do this. So the virtual cinema continues to go. We will continue to offer that at least through the next year. We're just hearing from Doug Clyde and Rich Bull in your reports that we're in this for the long haul as well, that we want to make sure we're presenting things like the Twilight Drive-In, you know, trying to be creative and innovative to get people together safely, and then have the virtual cinema always as an option for people that continue to want to stay at home and watch their films in that manner, which, you know, of course, we support and want to make sure people are comfortable but still able to access the best in independent cinema. So virtual cinema numbers are certainly not as robust as what we've seen at the Twilight Drive-In, but just, you know, remind people that those films and those film screenings, that ticket price supports Park City Film and helps us do things like the Twilight Drive-In. So we appreciate everyone that does tune in for that.
So have you started thinking about what happens this winter when it's too cold to be outside and you want to be back in the Santee Auditorium?
Yep. So we're actively in conversations with Park City Municipal Corp and the County Health Department to ensure that we can open up safely, you know, following, of course, all health and safety protocols that are dictated by not just the state, but the county. And then there's also an initiative called Cinema Safe that the National Association of Theater Owners has put together. And it's essentially kind of their good housekeeping seal of approval, saying these are the standards, you know, speaking with epidemiologists and looking at the latest research, these are the standards that movie theaters need to adhere to at a minimum level. And certainly you can go above and beyond. And that is our intention, of course, you know, to be as safe as we possibly can and exceed expectations there. So that we'll be looking at social distancing, we're looking at with 6 feet of distancing around related parties, looking at kind of clusters of two. It'll be about, we're estimating about 65 people in the theater, and that's out of 450 seats. So that's 14% of our normal capacity. And then just kind of, you know, again, following guidelines, cleaning regimes, social distancing. And so just working through that to make sure that when we do reopen, it is, you know, the safest place that we can make it and ensure that, you know, our patrons are comfortable being
yes.
there with us.
Will you have to raise ticket prices then to bring back the revenue, or will you have to add more screenings instead of just three nights?
You know, to be determined. I don't think that we would. It is not on the ballot or kind of on our slate of things to raise ticket prices. What we are offering right now, we were very fortunate to receive a grant from Shop in Utah. We've been using some of that money to incentivize people to come to the drive-in with gift certificates to local restaurants. We'll continue to do that once we go back in the Santee, you know, because we're certainly, as I mentioned earlier, quite, you know, well aware that we are part of a small ecosystem. And if the restaurants don't survive, then, you know, we're not going to survive either, that we're all in this together. So we want to help support them. But we're also using some funding from there to give a 50% discount off all of our memberships. And so lots of our film patrons join in the fall season. And so anyone that is up for renewal or wants to support what we do, We'd love to have you join us, and memberships now start at $27.50. So that's half off of $55. So you can, you know, get the benefits of membership, but also, you know, help ensure that we'll be back here when, you know, things get back to normal and we can start packing 450 people back in that theater. So, you know, no one knows what the next 12 months are going to look like. We want to make sure people have access to the arts. It's just amazing, again, you know, how much it connects and, you know, enlightens and lifts up our spirits. And that's something we want to make sure that we can continue to provide. So, you know, we really look to the community to say, we're going to keep our ticket prices the same. Please come visit us. If that's not something you're comfortable with, you know, please become a member or otherwise support us with PC, Give PC, of course, is coming up as well. But, you know, it's really with the community support that's gotten us this far. And we, you know, are extremely grateful for the support we've received and the partnerships we've been able to bring together, and like at the UOP. And, you know, we just encourage people, if you love the arts, you know, vote with your dollars. Independent cinema is in a challenging time, like many of the arts organizations that, you know, our reason for being is to bring people together. And that's going to be a little tricky right now, and certainly not at the levels that we're normally used to. You know, 50% of our revenue comes from ticket sales and concessions. So that'll look a little different this year, and we'll have to be creative and kind of pivot in terms of how we raise funds in different ways.
Yeah. And then what about that Real series that you hosted on Thursday nights, free screenings? I mean, a great partnership with important community organizations and topics being discussed, and, you know, usually with a film and a panel. Those off the calendar then for now?
No, we've still actually been doing those. But currently they're in a virtual setting. We haven't done them for the past month, but certainly since COVID started and shut us down, we've hosted 4 film screenings and had free screenings online, and then had a panel discussion via Zoom. And so we're now looking at how do we do that. You know, it's interesting when you think of the virtual cinema versus the in-person model, do you do them simultaneously and try to, you know, Zoom, you know, bring people in via Zoom for an in-person event, or do we do them separately? So that's, again, kind of things that we're working through. But no, absolutely. It's really important to us, again, that people have access to the arts. And we've been very fortunate. RapTax is one of our major sponsors. And that, you know, in part funds the free community screening. So we will continue them. It'll look different than it has in the past. I mean, everything does. I think that's kind of the phrase of the year. But no, we absolutely will continue Real Community Series. It's very important to us to support, you know, our brother and sister nonprofits and the work that they do and the missions that they, you know, they have. That's really what we use the films for, is to elevate their mission through film. And those conversations are so important, and we want to continue those. Absolutely.
Well, this time of year, you'd be busy going to film festivals. Telluride, of course, canceled. I'm not sure what happened to Montreal's festival. I mean, how are you learning about the new films being offered from the film festival circuit?
It's tricky. Toronto Film Festival went forward. There were, out of, like, 400 normally films that they have, they ended up with 50 that they brought on their slate. But only half of that 50 were accessible to residents of the United States, because it's called geogating. You can only watch them within a certain region. So we have a film booker, and so we're talking to our colleagues in other art houses that are able to watch films. You know, we're watching films. We can get screeners for a lot of films, so we're able to preview them at home for some of them. But it's a lot of reading the trade papers and talking to our colleagues about what's available. Fortunately, there were a lot of films kind of in the pipeline, certainly on the independent side, that are still available to us. You know, the news, of course, is full of Tenant and Wonder Woman and all of those big blockbuster films, which, you know, typically are not films we show anyway, but that is an indicator, of course, of how, you know, the industry as a whole is doing. So lots of documentaries are available right now, which, of course, we love, and we hear from our community that they love too. But it'll be, you know, time will tell. Sundance, of course, is on our horizon, and we'll be participating in that, you know, however that takes shape. So, yeah, it's very different and a little sad. I do miss not going to Telluride. But again, you know, there is an end, hopefully, to all of this, and we're looking forward to that and keeping going as best we can and trying to be creative in the meantime. And there's a lot of creative folks out there that we work with that we're really, you know, excited to find new solutions. I think that's, you know, again, being a small organization, kind of you have to be entrepreneurial and think of different ways to bring films to your communities and bring films to the big screen. And I still think, you know, as much as I love virtual cinema, there's nothing like seeing a movie in a theater surrounded by, you know, your friends and family and just, you know, that emotion that it evokes being with other people, and their response to these stories is so powerful. And so, you know, that I don't think will ever go away. And we certainly want to keep that going, you know, even in a more, you know, smaller fashion, you know, as we get through this.
Okay. Katie, appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you. ParkCityFilm.org. Please get your tickets. We look forward to seeing everyone at the Utah Olympic Park this weekend.
It's Katie Wang, Executive Director of Park City Film. Well, the Triple Crown softball tournament was canceled in July due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and the organizers were none too pleased about it. KPCW's Sean Higgins reports, despite the rocky summer, the tournament could return to Park City for the next 12 years.
With complications from the COVID-19 pandemic wreaking havoc on events throughout the summer, a number of mainstays on Park City's summer schedule were canceled. The Kimball Arts Festival, 4th of July festivities, and a slew of sports tournaments all fell victim to the pandemic, including the annual Triple Crown softball tournament. Originally scheduled for July 13th through the 18th, the Triple Crown tournament usually brings around 7,000 people to Park City throughout the course of the week and is responsible for a sizable chunk of July sales for Park City businesses and lodging. Triple Crown CEO Kerry King was frustrated at the time that Park City would have considered requiring measures like a 14-day quarantine for visiting teams, mandatory COVID-19 testing, sterilizing facilities between games, and limitations on spectator numbers if the tournament was to go forward. Triple Crown eventually withdrew their event shortly before the tournament was to begin. The Park City City Council is set to consider granting an extension of the Triple Crown tournament through 2021, as well as a 10-year contract to hold the event in Park City through 2032 at their September 17th meeting. Park City Manager Matt Dias tells KPCW the event has been held in Park City since 2003, and local stakeholders tell him the tournament is an essential part of Park City's summer economy.
And they've been great for Park City. They've supported all sorts of local clubs and local lodging institutions and restaurants, and we've got some fairly strong stakeholder input and feedback that this is a great boon to the economy during the summer months, but there are some negative impacts of this tournament, and that's something that City Council is going to have to weigh.
Dias says some of those negative impacts stem from increased noise, traffic, and potential neighborhood disturbances with a large event in town during peak summer vacation time.
You know, we'll get a lot of traffic, we'll get a lot of congestion, and I think people feel, you know, that those weeks during the summer, you know, are important for our quality of life, and we have the ability to take a deep breath without events in town. Conversely, they do fill a lot of rooms and a lot of seats in restaurants and shops and stores, and so clearly there's a balance that we need to strike.
The historic Park City Alliance represents the business community on Park City's Main Street and also took up the issue at their monthly board meeting on September 15th. Allison Kulo is the executive director of the organization and says the majority of the board was in strong favor of continuing the tournament in Park City, but a few business owners did have concerns about the impact of the tournament's parade on Lower Main Street.
It brings in so many different people who have never been to Park City, future guests that can come back. It brings families in, and it has minimal impacts but great rewards as far as the sales for Main Street. So we are supportive of a 10-year contract, and we are interested in continuing discussions with Triple Crown regarding their parade on Main Street. It may not be configured as it is right now.
The Triple Crown agreement is the first item on the City Council's agenda for September 17th, and the Council will be hearing public comments. The meeting is scheduled to begin at 3 p.m., and if you are interested in participating via Zoom, a link to all of the information can be found on our website, kpcw.org. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City.